Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Thursday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand here in the Skyline Studio atop the Chicago River with the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in. Okay, so what do you write with? You don't write at all anymore, do you? We type, we text, we scan maybe, but we don't really write. Well, there's a fountain pen shop in Chicago. They're at the Palmer House, I believe. It's the only fountain pen store in the city, or at least the only one I can find. Lisa Anderson is a co-founder. They actually have, they started in Wisconsin. They've got a shop up there, and now they've opened one about a year ago in Chicago. We'll talk about the business of fountain pens a little bit later in the program. I'd like to start on Thursdays with a look at tech and the issues around it. From CNET on a phone line now is, on the phone line with me is Ben Fox Rubin, senior reporter at CNET. Ben, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks for having me, and I write with a pen all the time.
Do
maybe
really?
I'll have to fly over to Chicago.
So a fountain pen? I can get you one for about $450.
Yes. Yeah, that sounds like a great price. I'll get a new fountain pen instead of a new phone. That would probably be much better for my brain
anyway.
You can't
take a picture with a fountain pen, but you can draw a really nice one.
Right, absolutely.
Okay, so Mark Zuckerberg is speaking. I think he's supposed to start right about now, giving a speech on, quote, voice and free expression, end quote. Zuckerberg, of course, under scrutiny because of, well, everything he does. But what is this voice and free expression stuff about?
It's a little unclear what exactly he's going to be talking about. Apparently, it's a very lengthy speech where he's going to be providing his, quote, unquote, take in a very broad fashion about I'm assuming what he means about the First Amendment. I'm assuming what he means about how people use Facebook, how people use Instagram, and what that means in their daily lives. Broadly speaking here, Zuckerberg is probably trying to do this because he's trying to be more transparent. He understands that Facebook is not viewed as positively as it used to be. And so he's trying to get out ahead and say something that maybe isn't going to be viewed negatively right out of the gate. That
so,
he's not just going to be talking only about scandals with Facebook. Maybe we're going to talk about how we can help connect people, how we might be able to help people with these platforms.
Well, that's what he started with, right? That Facebook was supposed to be for a way for people to communicate, to get to know each other, to build community. I mean, wasn't that one of his original platforms?
Yeah, and he talks a lot about that still. The problem is that we've seen some of the worst scandals in the tech industry really hit on Facebook. There have been data breaches. Cambridge Analytica was one of the most significant ones. And there was also significant concern about the Russian government potentially really hacking our election,
right,
using Facebook, using Twitter. So it's not really perceived in the same way as maybe it used to be, that it's this fun place for people to post their cat and baby pictures. It's something much more insidious than that. So Zuckerberg is really trying to retrain the narrative in many ways to say, like, hey, there are positives about Facebook, about these giant social platforms. They're not just ways to waste time and manipulate people. And we'll see what he has to say. I mean, he usually draws a very large crowd, so people will be writing about this. But hopefully he says something of meaning and substance, as opposed to just broad platitudes about Facebook is good.
Well, didn't he
something
do
along those lines?
Didn't he do sort of a listening tour or something a couple of years ago, and people thought he might be entering politics, and then he met with some conservatives over the summer or something? I mean, does any of this have to do with something other than Facebook?
I don't think so. At this point, he's really just, I would assume he's trying to right the ship at this point. Facebook is still obviously a juggernaut in social, but he also understands that there are a lot of folks at the table these days. So in my mind, and as he specifically stipulated, just meeting with conservatives should not in and of itself be viewed as controversial. I mean, if he were to meet with a group of liberals, is that a significant story, or is that something that's problematic? I mean, from what he specifically said, he said, I like to meet with all sorts of people. It's how you learn. People should try it sometime. Just kind of a dig to saying, like, hey, it's okay if I meet with conservatives. So,
yeah, no, I'm with him.
Whether,
that's right.
We
spend too much time with the people we only agree with, so I'm all for him there. I want to shift gears a little bit. You wrote a piece, a lengthy piece, on workers at Amazon, and this intrigues me, about how they're not, well, maybe some of them are teetering toward a union, but there's certainly these sort of pods within the world of Amazon that is really moving toward political action.
Yeah, and it's much broader than just Amazon. Obviously, I cover Amazon, so this was really the focal point. But when you think about the GM strike, when you think about Google, Microsoft, Wayfair employees that have really been speaking out a lot more often, it's much more significant in a certain extent with the tech industry, because the tech industry and their employees have largely been very secretive, very quiet,
right.
And more recently, they've really been trending more towards social activism. So,
Ben, they're not
another element of that.
They're not getting involved like GM and the UAW. They're striking over pay, healthcare, things like that. But from what I read, when it comes to the there have been some disputes over worker treatment and things at some of these
working
tech companies.
Conditions, yeah. Yes.
But for the most part, they seem to be outside of that, like global warming or there's social justice or issues such as that.
There's definitely both. There are a variety of warehouse groups that appear to be motivating each other and really snowballing to a certain extent, where there's been really big efforts in Minnesota that are now inspiring other warehouse groups. And a lot of those relate to working conditions at those warehouses, the pace of work, overworking people, firing people for issues that people feel aren't fair. But then there are also those elements that you talk about with the social issues, where there are employees that are standing up against Amazon, working with immigration and customs enforcement. There was also a big rally in Seattle right outside the main headquarters talking about climate change and how Amazon needs to do more specifically on the climate. So and for me, what's really interesting about it is that these employees are really putting their names in front of these issues. And they're saying, you know, here we are. We want to talk about these issues. And they're really trying to agitate for change at the company. And in certain cases, they've been successful.
Is it going to be, is Amazon one day going to be a union shop?
Amazon doesn't say that they're anti-union, but everything that I hear from employees on the ground is that they are.
Name a business.
And they try to fight against
unions. Name a big business that's pro-union. I don't think that's the way it works.
Right. So is it ever going to become a union shop? I mean, Amazon has certainly not encouraged that situation for a long time. But I think that, like with many things, once one domino falls, it could potentially all shift very quickly. But that's a hypothetical at this point. As it stands, the company is about 25 years old, and their entire U.S. workforce, which is about 300,000 people, none of them are unionized at the moment.
Ben Fox Rubin is a senior reporter at CNET. Ben, it was great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
It's 12:22. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Bill Geiger is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management, Chicago's retirement planning experts. Bill, welcome back.
Good afternoon, sir.
Okay, so the stock market's looking pretty good, right? We've been pretty steady for the last year. Interest rates remain low. Where is it that people should be putting their money if they're getting ready for retirement?
Well, this is kind of a dilemma right now, Steve. The stock market is close to its all-time high, and interest rates are close to their all-time low. Let me just tell you a story. I had a couple come in the office last week, 59-year-old couple, $1.5 million portfolio. They've done a really great job at savings. And I asked them what they were looking to accomplish. And the husband says to me, he says, Bill, we don't care about beating the S&P.
Okay.
He says, we don't care about a 60-40, that benchmark at all. He says, we care about taking 4 to 5 to 6% per year from our portfolio and for our money to last us for the next 20, 30, 40 years. And if you think about it, that's the same way big institutions like Harvard and Yale invest. They've got scholarships that they take money out every year.
Their endowment, they've got the huge endowments.
In their huge endowment, they take 4, 5, 6% a year out of their endowments, and they want their endowment to be around for 100 years and more.
Right.
So it's the same sort of thing. And there's a book by the guy that manages Yale's funds, I forget the name of it, but he basically said that. He says, we don't care about beating the 60-40 S&P and bond blend. He says, we care about being able to meet those goals. And it's the same sort of focus you should have as you're coming up to retirement. You want to have 4 to 5 to 6% per year coming off. You don't ever want to worry about that stopping.
So as long as you can look at it and say it's set up or figured we're going to get 4 or 5%, then you're fine.
Yeah, 4, 5, 6%. And we got that for the rest of our life. And in 20, 30, 40 years from now, the money's still there. I mean, that's the ideal focus for approaching retirement.
Look, you just gave us a Harvard education. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Now, what is it I hear about this airbag on your retirement? What does that mean?
Listen, most people want to stay fully invested. I mean, it's hard not to. It's hard to pull the plug at this point. And it's just like driving a car. You drive a car every day. Did you think about your airbag this morning?
I did not, no.
You did not.
No.
You're driving down the road. Maybe you're driving a little bit fast. But
I was not, no.
No, but that airbag is there to protect you. You get in a wreck, it's going to protect you.
Right.
Well, we add an airbag of sorts to our clients' stock portfolios to where if the market really takes a big downturn, they only go down a certain amount before they stop, and it protects them, just like an airbag.
How does it explain for me how that works?
Well, it's a little bit longer than a...
Speak slowly, I can get it. No.
Okay. Yeah. We use two-year puts on the portfolio. Basically, a put makes money if the market goes down. So the market goes down, you're losing money in your portfolio, but you're making it on that put. So it protects you from having big losses.
And
if you can do that, not have big losses, you can stay in the market, you can do 4, 5, 6% a year over time.
Right, and that's the goal, 4, 5, 6%
to withdraw. 4, 5, 6% a year over the time. You want dependable income, and we use alternative investments to generate that. And these clients, I'm smiling when the guy was talking because he sounded just like the guy that runs Yale's
right. Which is pretty unusual, right, for someone who comes in with that level, because that's what you're giving them, or that's what you're trying to help people learn about, the fact that they don't have to do that.
Yeah, is to get away from this focus on beating the market and get tight into a focus of what you really want for the rest of your life. You want to be able to take $5,000, $10,000 a month out for the rest of your life, whatever that number is, and for the last 20, 30, 40 years, and not worry about it. Steve, I know you're going to talk about this in just a moment. Folks, if you're out there and you'd like to kind of explore this idea, we're going to sit down with the first five people who call in who have at least $500,000 in their portfolio. And we'll go over how to do this and help you put together a plan for doing it yourself.
Bill Geiger, nice to see you. Thanks for the airbag talk.
You're welcome, sir.
Thank you, Jen DeSalvo. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Okay, this might sound a little odd to you, but I used to interview a lot of writers. I hosted a podcast for BarnesandNoble.com back in the very early days of podcasts, and a number of them would write their novels or their nonfiction books by hand, by pen and paper. And the idea was that it took more... It wasn't that it was more effort, but it was more deliberative. I mean, words on a typewriter or on a keypad are a little cheaper than they are pen to paper. It takes more time to do it, more effort to do it. And thinking about that, you know, we kind of are getting more and more separated from our words. It used to be that we'd type off a quick email, then it was a text. Now it's voice to text. We're not taking time to write our words carefully. So that brings me to Anderson's Pens, which opened up about a year ago, I think at the Palmer House. Lisa Anderson is a co-owner, and she joins us on a phone line. Lisa, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
All right, how about that? Words by typewriter, I keep saying typewriter, words by keypad are just a little too cheap.
They are. I think there's a movement these days, getting back to mindfulness, getting back to slowing down, you know, Marie Kondo, you know, keep what you love kind of thing.
Right.
And with all the texting and email, the handwritten word has really gone away. And there really has been a recent resurgence, and it's been wonderful to see all these people excited about writing by hand again.
Well, I was going to say, if the art of writing by hand is going away, what in the world were you thinking opening up a fountain pen store?
Well, I was thinking that we already had one, and we love Chicago. It's a big market, and why not go big or go home?
Is it the only fountain pen store in Chicago?
Yes, we are. The only dedicated pen, ink, and stationery store in the city.
Okay, let's go back to where you started then. You mentioned opening in Chicago because the original store is in Appleton, Wisconsin. Now, if there's only one in Chicago with its population, how are you doing at a fountain pen store in Appleton, Wisconsin?
Well, we originally opened the store to get it out of the house. We had pens in the bathroom, in the dining room, in the kitchen, in my closet. And in order to stay happily married, we moved it out of the house into a retail space. And my husband and I both have retail experience, so that was a no-brainer.
Are you the pen person, or is he or both of you?
Actually, that's how we met.
Yeah,
we
really
are both pen people. But Appleton has a surprising number of pen collectors in the area. There's even an Appleton Pen Club, but we have a lot of regulars. And in the summer especially, a lot of people make the Appleton store a destination on their way to Door County or where, you know, places like that.
Okay, that's interesting to me because I'm looking on your website. I mean, you can buy a pen. I saw one for $450, right? What's the most expensive pen you sell?
We can get anything that any of our manufacturers offer. So I suppose if you wanted a $50,000 pen, I can make that happen
okay,
for you.
Let's
but they start.
Yeah.
They start at $3, so it doesn't have to be $450.
Okay, so that maybe answers my question, because I'm thinking if I buy a $450 pen, I'm not going to buy any other pens. I mean, who are your repeat customers?
Oh,
or am I?
You are. You
really?
Probably will. It may not be another $450 pen, but you may want a daily writer. We've certainly got lots of options under $100. The sweet spot for a lot of people seems to be between $150 and $250 because at that price point you get a gold nib. But it just depends on what you're looking for.
And
sometimes all you want to do... Go ahead.
Does a gold nib make me smarter?
It might make you enjoy the writing experience a little bit more, but the modern steel nibs are really great as well.
And so tell me again then, are your customers by and large collectors? Are they buying curiosities? Or are they, you know, people using these functional pens?
We've got basically four kinds of customers here in Chicago. We've got the local pen enthusiasts who are just excited to have an actual dedicated store. We've got, since we're in the Palmer House, a lot of hotel guests and tourists,
mm-hmm.
A lot of conference attendees. And so often, a father will want to bring something home as a souvenir to the kids or to the wife. And then visitors who make us a destination. They'll travel from states away just because they have nothing in their state. We had people in from Michigan last week.
I get three or four of those, but if I go on a business trip and bring my wife home a pen, I don't know if that would work for me.
Well, we've got fun, bright-colored pens for kids and notebooks. Maybe the wife is into journaling or something. There's all sorts of different things.
I see that the pens come from around the world, or the paper comes from around the world. Are the pens, is there a U.S. manufacturing business with pens, or are most of them from overseas, or where do you get the pens?
There are a few manufacturers who are based in the U.S., but most of the pens are made overseas. We carry several lines of pens that are made in Japan, a few in Italy, several from Germany, and then, of course, some are made overseas in Asian countries.
Okay, so let's end where we started. You said you met your husband because of pens. Tell me that story.
We used to bet against each other on eBay when you could see the other person's screen name. And so I guess you could say that eBay worked as a online dating for us.
Well,
but we met in person in Chicago at a pen show, and we discovered we each had one half of an engraved set with an unusual name on it. And so when we got married, we used that to sign the marriage certificate.
Wow, that's a great story. And I love the fact that the digital world brought your pen people together.
Absolutely.
All right, it's called Anderson's Pens. It's at the Palmer House. There's a website too, right, Lisa? What's the website?
AndersonPens.com.
Well, nice to talk to you. I wish you continued success.
Thank you so much, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. We all know that high taxes are kind of the norm around here, and these days we're getting pretty creative with the new ones. The latest tax proposal to help with the city's finances is something called the congestion tax on vehicles in the city, and the founders of SpaceBot Surge think they may have figured a way out to do it. The startup is proposing to set up solar cameras around the city to take pictures of cars based on how far they travel, and during busy times, certain vehicles would get taxed. At first, it may sound like, what? I already pay enough taxes in this city. But thankfully, their proposal would start out with commercial vehicles and delivery trucks first. It could range anywhere between 70 cents to $5. And speaking of downtown, the city has agreed to change the no-weed zone for business owners. It was originally going to be the entire loop that was a no-go for dispensaries to pop up, but now it's been condensed to the main shopping area. Basically, anything west of State Street in the loop is okay, and east all the way to the lake is not. January 1st is coming up quick, and there's still more to get done before kicking this industry into high gear. We can tell pot jokes now. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Amy Guth is in the studio. She's the host of the Daily Gist podcast from Crane Chicago Business, and she looks a little glassy-eyed. What's going on?
Me?
Oh, no, I guess it's not glassy. Not until after January 1st.
I mean,
right?
I'm wearing the glasses. Right, not till after January 1st. So some big news on that front today. There's been a lot in the last 24 hours, right? The city council was in session yesterday, and there was some consternation a little bit. There were some aldermen saying we should delay
right. All
of this and make it more fair and put more focus on minority communities. But just on the business front today, the politics part aside, Cresco Labs, which we have talked about a lot, they're a very, very big player in the medical marijuana space. They announced yesterday that they received their state approval to sell marijuana for recreational use out of the five existing medical dispensaries that they have. They said that makes them the first company in the state to get licenses to both grow and sell. Other companies are just kind of focusing on one or the other, but they're going to do all of that. They've been in headlines because they've made some huge acquisitions in other states. So they're probably going to be like the Walmart of
marijuana. So that means Champaign, Wrigleyville, Rockford, yep. Elmwood Park, and Buffalo Grove.
That's right.
They've got medical dispensaries there now, and they're going to be allowed just automatically to convert, not to convert them, but to add on retail.
That's right. And, you know, if going the way that Las Vegas did, you know, I did a little bit of research on that. I was not there at any of them, but I was interviewing some of the people by phone in Vegas right before they ran out. And they really took a very, like, spa-like approach. It wasn't a head shop. It was like a very fancy. And I imagine that I kind of get the sense that's what's going to happen here.
We were talking with Alderman Brendan Riley earlier this week on the John Williams Show about that. You know, he says that people have an idea of this sort of
dirty, gritty place,
and that's not the way it works out, that they really are high end. They're more like an Apple store.
That's right. They're really, I mean, some of them are, you know, online, you can see they're very beautiful and very clean and very well lit. It's also interesting. I think it'll be interesting to watch that here. I know in other states that have already kind of, there are steps ahead of us using like the Loomis armored trucks, you know, to go around, because it's an all cash business, because you're not going to really use your debit card right there at this moment.
Is it true? It still is all cash pretty much?
For the most part, it's pretty much all cash. And so, you know, there has to be a lot more thought into having all this cash around and how you deal with it.
All right. Read more, listen more to that at The Daily Gist, the podcast from Crane Chicago Business, dropping this afternoon. Amy, thanks for coming by.
Thanks so much.